everyone, and welcome to this, the third episode of our Fraud Files podcast. My name is Susanna Cogman. I'm a partner in the Corporate Crime and Investigations team and one of the co-hosts of this podcast series. Today, we're going to be talking about jurisdiction and specifically the jurisdictional scope of the failure to prevent offence. And I'm delighted to be joined by two of my colleagues to assist us in unpacking that concept. So firstly, Brian Spiro, one of my partners in crime in the team. Brian, do you want to say hello?
Thanks, Susanna. Yes. Hello, everyone. Greetings.
And secondly, I am joined by Ali Grodsky, who is a senior associate in the Corporate Crime and Investigations team.
Hi, everyone.
Perfect. So to kick us off, Brian, can you briefly recap us on the essential ingredients of the failure to prevent fraud offence that we're going to be talking about today?
Yes. Well, as a brief recap, all organisations, and in particular to note that includes non-UK organisations, can potentially commit this offence if they meet the specified criteria under the Act and fail to prevent a relevant UK fraud. The precise jurisdictional scope of the fraud offence is dependent on that of the relevant underlying fraud, most of which could be extraterritorial, but there has to be some act or omission within the UK. So the scope is potentially very broad. In theory, a non-UK organisation could commit the offence if a non-UK associate commits a fraud, as long as there is a relevant event, which could include an omission or a loss, has taken place in the UK. So the simplest example of that would be all the actual positive acts have been committed overseas, but there has been a UK victim.
Okay. And that, I think, is different from the failure to prevent bribery offence, which I know many people listening are probably more familiar with. So can you sort of help us with what that sort of difference is?
Yes, the key difference, Susanna, is that under the Bribery Act, it's a different test. It applies to companies incorporated in the UK, which carry or those that carry on business or part of their business in the UK. And once that criteria has been satisfied, then the bribery can occur anywhere in the world. There does not have to be any positive acts or omissions or losses occurring in the UK. It is really where the home of the business or part of the business is in the UK. So that's the key difference.
Okay, can you perhaps provide some examples to bring that to life a bit for our listeners?
Well, yeah, let me give a theoretical or hypothetical example. Let's say we have a French company that has a UK branch, and one of the employees of that French company based in Timbuktu commits a bribery offence. Because the French company carries on part of its business in the UK, despite the fact that bribery has been committed overseas, and despite the fact the bribery was committed by an employee of a French company, nonetheless, the Section 7 offence of failing to prevent the bribe being paid could bite in the UK, and indeed in my theoretical example would bite in the UK. There's a separate question, of course, as to whether the UK investigating and prosecuting authorities, the SFO, would think there's sufficient public interest to pursue that. But nonetheless, at least as far as the law is concerned, the SFO, the UK, would have jurisdiction. But in that scenario, if the employee of the French company has committed the fraud entirely in Timbuktu and no acts have been committed in the UK, there is no losses to any UK victims, then the failing to prevent fraud offence would not bite. So the jurisdictional scopes are different, work in a different way, and in many ways the Bribery Act has a wider jurisdiction than the failing to prevent offence.
I see. So with the Bribery Act, we're focusing very much on effectively the jurisdiction of the relevant commercial organisation. And with failure to prevent fraud, we're looking at the jurisdiction over the predicate offence, in that case, the fraud.
That's right. And of course, having said the Bribery Act in many ways has a wider jurisdiction, I say in many ways because not entirely. So as I said at the outset, there's a key difference here that a company with no UK home and no UK business can fall under this new offence, which would not be the case in the Bribery Act. So it's quite complicated.
Got you. OK, so if our key focus for failure to prevent fraud is on whether the UK, and I'm calling it the UK for convenience as opposed to England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, of course, but whether the UK would have jurisdiction over the fraud offence. And so turning to Ali, perhaps we can sort of help the audience understand a bit more how the scope of those fraud offences work. Perhaps if you can just kick us off by reminding us which offences are sort of predicate fraud offences for the purposes of failure to prevent fraud.
Yeah, so there are 7 fraud offences in total that are specified for the purposes of the failure to prevent fraud offence. So you've got the primary Fraud Act offences, you've got fraud by false representation, failing to disclose information or abuse of position, and then you've also got fraudulent trading, false accounting, and obtaining services dishonestly, as well as cheating the public revenue.
Okay, and how does the sort of jurisdiction work for those offences?
For the vast majority of them, just to add further complexity to this area, which we always like, for the majority of them, the Criminal Justice Act gives them extraterritorial jurisdiction. So the UK court, so to speak, or courts in England and Wales will have jurisdiction if a relevant event in relation to those offences occurs in England and Wales. So a relevant event means any act or omission or other event, proof of which is required for conviction of the offence. So in relation to the Primary Fraud Act offences, for example, the relevant event will include the occurrence of a gain or a loss.
Okay, and perhaps as I asked Brian to do, you could give us an example or two to try and
bring that to life
a little bit more. It just does rather sound as if we've just read a textbook. I know you have, but how does that work in practice?
So what you could have is, and slightly turning back to some of the examples that Brian gave at the start, what you could have is an overseas employee who dishonestly makes a false representation, perhaps say in an investment prospectus or marketing materials accompanying a product, and they do so intending to cause loss and to benefit their employer, and UK investors or customers are impacted and experience a loss. So in that case, the sort of predicate offence will be fraud by false representation. And there, the relevant event is the occurrence of a loss, and that has occurred in the UK because there were UK victims.
Got you. And I think you said that kind of relevant offence test is applies to the majority of the fraud offences, which are predicates for failure to prevent fraud, but that fraudulent trading has a slightly different approach. So how does that work?
Yes. So there is one predicate offence which is under the Companies Act, and that's the offence of fraudulent trading. So that's not within scope of this relevant event test, but the kind of jurisdictional scope there is a little bit more straightforward because it's an offence that can only be committed in relation to a UK company. There is a sort of similar offence dealing with similar conduct of fraudulent trading, which can apply to sole traders and other entities that aren't within scope of that particular offence, which might therefore include an overseas company, and that's under Section 9 of the Fraud Act. So that is separately a predicate offence for the purposes of the failure to prevent fraud offence and is subject to the relevant event test.
Okay. So I suppose taking a step back, what are the implications of all of that. So how should companies be thinking about jurisdiction in the context of kind of preparing for the offence coming in due course? I will turn back to Brian for that one, please.
Yes, well, Ali mentioned this is a complicated area, which I agree with. She then said, which we welcome, and I understand as lawyers we like to grapple with these complexities. However, I think it doesn't do any favours for our clients, for companies to have such a complicated jurisdictional backdrop, because it's quite hard to separate the different strands. I'm going to start, Suzanne, with saying what I'm sure good companies do in any event, which is try their utmost to prevent fraud occurring in any part of their organisation or associated parties and the such like. And I'm sure that all major companies and medium-sized companies already have in place robust anti-fraud measures, and that should continue. Having said that, they need to be looked at, I think, in the context now of this new law to see whether or not they are adequate to provide the protection that will be needed in the event that any of these offences occur that could give rise to UK jurisdiction, possibly investigation and prosecution. So the starting point, of course, is to look at your existing systems and policies and procedures and training programs and see that they are sufficiently robust in order to give the protection that is needed. And any company is going to want to think about its failing to prevent projects, its failing to prevent measures, risks assessments, controls, and the such like. Normally, for an international business, you want these to be on a group-wide basis, and that's a good starting point. One can see as a strict sort of black letter law, one could separate jurisdictions and ask yourself the question as to whether a fraud committed in a particular part of the globe is going to necessarily impact you in the UK and give rise to a liability in the UK. And one again could see, at least theoretically, an ability to ring fence different jurisdictions and have different policies and procedures to ensure they are compliant in those jurisdictions and not giving rise to liability in the UK. I doubt that any company would think that a good practice. It's going to create an extra amount of work, and it's also, I think, going to possibly give rise to criticism as to why you're having different failing to prevent policies and procedures in different parts of the world. So my view is that one looks at this globally, looks at best practice, looks for the most robust systems that's going to prevent fraud in any event. But that what will flow from that, of course, is the foundations of the ability to properly defend yourself in the event that a fraud is committed somewhere in the world that could give rise to liability because you've had the proper reasonable procedures in place.
I suppose it depends a little bit on whether you think your failure to prevent project and controls, etc., will actually be effective in preventing fraud. Because as you say, Brian, if you think they will be, then you would expect you would want to extend them more broadly for all sorts of reasons, kind of commercial, reputational, criminal, etc., etc. If you think this is a completely pointless exercise, which merely gives you a piece of paper that hopefully sets you up to maximise your chance of saying you have reasonable procedures in the event that a fraud occurs, then you might scope your project by reference specifically to the offence, because you are trying to set yourself up specifically to have a defence to the offence. But it is a slightly depressing view of the world if you think that your project will only set you up to do that and will not have actually any merit in terms of assessing your exposure to fraud or assisting in mitigating your risk in relation to the same.
Yeah, and of course, we await the guidelines, and obviously the guidelines, as with the Bribery Act, and I think here even more so, are going to be a crucial document for companies to look at and initially assess their existing policies and procedures against those guidelines and see whether there are gaps or weaknesses which need to be remedied.
Yeah, and I guess it follows from what we were saying earlier, that if you were to take a sort of narrow approach, so let's say you're a UK kind of multinational business and you're just trying to map your project by reference to the scope of the offence, then you can't do that on a necessarily entity by entity basis, because you'll be needing to look actually at instead UK nexus and what the risk is of committing a fraud over which there is UK jurisdiction.
Yeah, and the other thing which is going to give rise to the need to look at fresh eyes is going to be the entity that is not a UK entity, doesn't trade in the UK, but has UK investors or UK customers, and therefore potentially is going to be pulled into to this law.
Very good. Ali, did you have any further thoughts?
I think Brian's just touched on a really important point. So, for non-UK companies who might be sort of coming alive to this new offence and thinking about their potential exposure to it, firstly, as we've said, any company can be within scope of the offence if you meet the criteria for being a large organisation under the Act. It's not confined to UK incorporated companies. But a key thing, because of the sort of connection to the jurisdictional scope of the predicate offences, will be to think about what your UK touch points are. So, as Brian says, do you have UK investors, customers, suppliers, shareholders, creditors? And that will help you understand your exposure specifically to the offence. But as we've just discussed, thinking about it on that kind of granular level might not be particularly clear cut nor helpful when you are no doubt seeking to ensure that on a group wide basis, you do have controls in place to prevent fraud.
Super, thank you. And I know, Ali, you have very kindly written a short briefing which will explain all of what we have been discussing today, if anyone wants to look at that in black and white. And I think a link to that will be in the show notes, as I understand they're called, in due course. So thank you very much, Brian and Ali. I think that's it for today. Thank you to our listeners, and we will be back in due course with the next thrilling installment of the Fraud Files podcast. Thanks very much.
Thank you.